From 12 News, this is Newsmakers.
With David Cicilline officially done as a U.S. rep, the race to replace him is likely to heat up. At least it should, considering there is only 3 months to primary day. With a crowded field of Democrats, it's been difficult for any one candidate to stand out. This week on Newsmakers, the outlook in the 1st District congressional race with a political roundtable. Welcome to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White. Do not change your channel. This is not a Newsmakers repeat. Ted Nesi is back.
Back, folks. Here I am.
After six weeks, good to have you back. And we welcome Kara Cromwell, political strategist, and 12 News political analyst Joe Fleming. Thanks, guys, for coming in to talk about. Let's start with the first congressional race. I cannot, as I said in the open, 3 months away to primary day, which is just stunning to me. September 5th is the primary. Did you expect it to be this quiet at this point, Joe?
Not at all. I expected a lot more action by now. The candidates just are not coming forward to contact with the voters. I mean, realizing they're trying to build staff, they want to raise money. They're not going to have a ton of money in this race. So they're going to manage it. The problem is no one knows who these candidates are at this point. Name recognition of all of them is probably very low. The lieutenant governor and Aaron Regenberg are probably the two highest, but everybody else is way down there with name recognition. And I think most voters have no idea what any of these candidates stand for or if they're paying any attention to this race at all.
And Kara, I want you to weigh in on that. We should remind our viewers, you've managed a first congressional race before, a decade ago. But, you know, but no, you
was more than it was more than a decade.
I was trying to be.
Oh, yeah.
You two were there, too.
Yeah, we were. That's true.
I covered that. And I remember, now, look, it wasn't a special election, you know, but there was a lot more activity. Same question to you. Are you surprised how quiet it's been?
I am, although I'm going to blame it on, I think some of these candidates really aren't that serious. I think some of them have a free pass with their other jobs and are just kind of putting their name in.
Okay, but some of them are serious.
Well, and the ones that are serious, I think should be more active. And I think the ones that are serious, are very serious, have been very active. I don't think that they're using what we call free media, i.e. the news media, as well as they could be, certainly. But I think they're very active, you know, on social media and other places. I think we've laughed before about the campaigns don't actually happen on Twitter, but I think sometimes kids today do think they do. So,
expand on that, because you and I talked a lot about this in the 22 gubernatorial race, particularly besides Dan McKee, there weren't a lot of candidates that, to use her term, went for earned media. So that's going out and saying, hey, I'm going to hold this press conference. We're going to talk about X, Y, or Z. That just was not happening. Dan McKee was signing a lot of bills into law, and he leveraged his office, you know, for campaign purposes. And again, we're not. What's up with that?
I find it astonishing to see it again, and especially what do we keep saying? These candidates don't have money. Well, yes, it takes a little organization and a little effort to try to, you know, throw a news conference, come up with a reason that maybe some reporters will show up. But the whole point is, it's free if you do a good job with it, and it can be a way to offset financial advantages. I don't know that almost any of these candidates have held any events. In fact, one of the things that has surprised me. Kickoff day. That is a day a candidate is almost guaranteed to get a little coverage. Get on Channel 10 and Channel 12. You know, get Channel 12 and Channel 10, excuse me. I should say in the right order for here. You know, get in the paper, etc. And what do? You just say 10 a.m. tomorrow. They stand there. I remember, you know who did that really well was Greg Amore, Secretary of State candidate.
Yeah, yeah.
He knew that race was not going to get a lot of attention. He had his one bite at the apple. So that day, when he kicked off, he had this cast of thousands outside EP High School. Nice big signs. He got on the news with that. And people at home might think, well, this reporter's just annoyed because they want something to write about. But it perplexes me, because then later on you'll hear from candidates, well, why isn't anyone talking about it? Why isn't this doing anything?
We have plenty to cover.
Yeah.
It's not like we're pining for it. It's just more of an analysis as to why they're not doing it. Why aren't they doing it?
I think it takes work. And I think that there are not that many candidates in this race that are willing
to. How much work does that take?
Well, a little bit more that some of them are willing to do, I think it's the reality. But I don't disagree. If it's free, it's for me as a staff member. That is a free hit. And so I would take it. I'd be putting out a press release every day. I joke that the campaign I ran was like on, you know, spit and duct tape, you know, as far as funding. Did not have money.
Right.
And I put the candidate out as much as possible in front of a camera. And every time I could find a few hundred voters, he would go there.
I mean,
shook hands with the Paw Sox every night.
The front runner is, or at least one of the perceived front runners, is Lieutenant Governor Speedy Montes. Mm-hmm. I remember, Tim, when the day she announced, our Steph Machado wanted to interview her and do a story about her announcement.
Right.
She was unavailable. I mean, to not be available to do interviews on the day you kick off your campaign for Congress, just maybe I'm just getting old and kind of old school, but it just mystifies me when you'd think candidates would want any chance they have in a low profile race to get
and
their name out.
And I think that's a situation for her where she has to be careful because she is Lieutenant Governor and does have a CD2 job as well to not do that.
I think a lot of the candidates feel they don't have to do this, that this is such a small turnout race. They have to go out there and identify the voters, find endorsements from political groups that would endorse them, and get those voters. That doing the press conferences is not the big thing. It's not going to get them elected in this race. It's going to be more of conserving your money to the end, identifying your voters, getting endorsements. And that's what I think a lot of the candidates have been doing. And they don't care about the press conferences.
That's interesting. I mean, I think we could both be right in terms of there's going to be candidates who are just focused on those votes,
right,
and the ones that I think are just not all that invested in the race.
We had a big endorsement, you know, relatively speaking, this week. You reported, broke, I think, that former Attorney General Patrick Lynch endorsed Gabe Amo for Congress. Strong Pawtucket connection there. What was behind that endorsement?
A long relationship, which is often the case in politics.
Yeah,
Gabe Amo grew up in Pawtucket. Obviously, the Lynches are synonymous with Pawtucket. And I think Gabe Amo's first time he ever worked in politics was as a teenage volunteer on an early Patrick Lynch for AG campaign. So Patrick Lynch has known him a long time. Amo considers mentor. It was interesting because Patrick Lynch actually has not dabbled too much in front face.
Yes.
You know, we got to remember, he was a high and rising star in
ran
the 2000s,
governor.
Ran for governor, and then after that governor campaign didn't work, he really did kind of step back from the spotlight. So it was interesting to see him come out, and I think for Gabe Amo, who's trying to, you know, convince as someone who's never run for elected office here, people that he's a serious candidate, getting some validation is part of why his campaign was happy to have Lynch's imprimatur on that, to say, look, I am serious, just like the others who've already run for high office.
And you're a son of Pawtucket, so I do want you to weigh in on that. The endorsement came shortly after Pawtucket Mayor Don Grebian said he's not running for Congress.
Right.
Is there a connection to that timing, you think, or was it coincidental?
I think it wasn't a connection at all. I think Don Grebian decided that he did not want to run. He was waiting till later on, till the field sort of settled down, and then he decided to make his announcement. I think the Patrick Lynch thing will help some in Pawtucket, but again, the Lynches have been out of power in Pawtucket for many, many years. So I think his influence in Pawtucket is not as big as it used to be.
Yeah, was Grebian aligned with the Lynches? Or
so
was he
that
with the
was
other,
the basis of my question.
Okay.
Yeah,
Grebian came in after. Don Grebian was first elected to city council in 1997.
Well, let me ask it a different way. If Don Grebian said that he was running for Congress, would Lynch have endorsed Gabe Amo?
I don't know what the connection is with the Lynch and the Grebians.
So I think that those personal endorsements are fairly significant because, you know, Patrick has made however many enemies now, right? And the fact that he doesn't weigh in.
15 and counting.
Right. The fact that he doesn't weigh in often and is willing to kind of say, yeah, that's my guy. And same with the mayor of Newport, another individual endorsement.
Yeah,
so I think when you see those, I think they're meaningful.
And what happened when Gabe Amo, you know, when he got that endorsement? You wrote a story on it, which goes back to the top
news
of this show, that he generated news. And, you know, was it at the top of our newscast? It was not. But it made our newscast, and it was on our website. And if you want to learn a little bit more, who is this Gabe Amo guy, you Google it. Your story's coming up.
Yeah, and another example of a candidate who I do think is making some effort to kind of break through is Aaron Regenberg, the former state rep and lieutenant governor candidate, who is, you know, he's always been a very progressive candidate, and he is doing everything he can to make clear to any voter paying attention he is the left-wing candidate. He is the only significant Democrat in the race who said he would have voted no on the debt ceiling bill this week. All the others said they would have reluctantly in general voted in favor of it, as did the delegation, but he said he was a no, along with progressives like AOC and Bernie. I think he called for Justice Thomas's impeachment.
Yep.
You know, taking positions that are further to the left than than the average person's going to be, to tell the voters, you know, in a race that, in an election that's going to be divided up so much, hey, to the folks who are on the left side of the spectrum, I'm going to be your guy. I'm the candidate. He wants to get through to those people.
You weren't here. Well, go ahead, Kara.
I was just going to say that's an interesting strategy to tack all the way to the left like that and stake out positions that don't necessarily speak to what we're used to with our delegation, mm-hmm. right? In terms of I would be something different, and I'm not sure if that is going to, you know, speak well to all of the
people. Well, and even Aaron Regenberg, even in a secto, seems almost not sure how far he wants to go with that, because when I just said, well, that's a break with Cicilline, who he's trying to replace, who voted for the debt ceiling bill, he was like, well, no, I respect everybody who voted for it. I just have a different analysis. So kind of saying, I'll take those kind of votes, but I'll still be mainstream enough that I'll be like the rest of the delegation. It's an interesting kind of straddling there.
It's definitely odd. Like, I'm going to send up flares, but I'll definitely still bring home the bacon.
but in this race, if that straddling gets you 18% of the vote, that could be enough to win.
Oh, yes. Depending on how many candidates.
Yeah, how many candidates in the end. But, I mean, he's thinking, I got a block of votes here. If I can grab these votes and hold on to them, I could possibly win this thing by just grabbing a few more votes elsewhere in the district.
So you say Aaron Regenberg is so far the most progressive candidate in the first congressional race. You haven't been on the show, but I know you've seen it. We had Aaron Regenberg on the program, and we talked to him about this. He has gotten a lot of pushback from progressive groups that have come out. There was one remarkable letter, and I can't remember who it was from, who just blasted Aaron Regenberg. And again, these are from the very left side of the party. What do you make of that? What's going on behind the curtain?
Well, one thing is, you know, whether it's the, you know, left-wing side of the Democratic Party or the right-wing side of the Republican Party, often there's a lot of interpersonal tensions that can bleed over. And clearly Aaron Regenberg has not created universal allies among the other progressives, especially the whole, you know, Rhode Island political co-op versus the David Siegel wing of the left wing in Rhode Island. There's a lot of different, you know, ways that gets cut. But I think what the Regenberg people would say is, okay, yes, he has some vocal critics among some of the left-wing folks in Rhode Island. On the other hand, he has the Working Families Party endorsed him right away. Climate Action RI endorsed him this week. Other groups have gotten behind him. The one, Our Revolution, that came out of Bernie Sanders. So I think he thinks, for the average voter, they're not going to notice the stuff the insiders do, some fighting among the lefts. And he thinks he can be that candidate.
Yeah, he said on the show that, that shows he has disagreed with the far left side of the party, and that shows that he can work mm-hmm. if he goes to Washington with a broader spectrum within the party and possibly across the aisle. We're going to go to a break soon, but any final thoughts before we do that, Joe?
Well, I was just going to say one thing is the fact that simply we're saying the primary is 3 months away. It's really 2.5 months. Mm. Early voting starts August 16th.
Yeah,
so these candidates have to really stop moving really soon. And I thought they were going to stop moving in May. So this is kind of a surprise to me that no one's really started to get out there and make a name for themselves.
And who knows when any of them, how many will go on television with an ad campaign and when they'll be able to do so because of the lack of money.
Well, that's what I want to talk about when we come back. You sort of gave us a little insight as to where some of the campaign war chests stand within the campaign. So when we come back, we're going to talk about that. We have a political roundtable this week on Newsmakers. We'll be right back. Well, I guess I want to state a fact, and you tell me if I'm wrong. If Jack Reed retires, you would strongly consider jumping into the Senate race.
Jack Reed's not going to retire.
That's not the question I asked.
And I'm starting a new job.
I understand.
No, I've made a commitment to the Rhode Island Foundation. I'm going to approach that job with the same seriousness and commitment and dedication that I approach to all the jobs I've taken, and I'm looking forward to doing that for a good long time.
People at home did not hear a no, though.
Look, I'm starting a new job that I am incredibly excited about, and I'm going to devote all of my energy to that.
Well, welcome back to Newsmakers. Tim White, Ted Nesi, Joe Fleming, Kara Cromwell, Political Roundtable. Before I get any nasty grams from the Senator Reed's office, we have no reason to believe that Senator Jack Reed is retiring. He's up in 26.
26.
Yeah. So, but it's more.
And I truly don't expect him to, but after the last 2 years, we didn't expect Langevin to retire, and then we didn't expect Cicilline to retire, so we got to be on guard.
Yeah, right. but really, fundamentally, the question is this the last time we see David Cicilline in politics, you think?
I don't know. I've got to just tip my hat to him and really our whole delegation, because, and a lot of people don't know this, but Rhode Islanders, people from New England, when there's a short flight from Washington, our members work so much harder than the ones that have to
go to California
or somewhere else, because our folks come home every weekend, and then they're everywhere. And I honestly don't think I've ever seen anyone who is more everywhere than David Cicilline.
It's true. And so, you got to campaign every 2 years. It's exhausting.
Oh, and work so hard. Other members from faraway states, they're in D.C. for the weekend. They have the time off. Our folks really just start working. So I don't think we've seen the last of him, but I think he'll be very visible at Rhode Island Foundation, which I think will be a good thing for our state.
Yeah, David's come a long way since he was first elected. I saw some polling numbers years ago.
First elected for state rep, for mayor,
for Congress. His polling numbers were very low.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a lot of trouble. Now he's really changed his image. He's known as a person who's in the state all the time. He's known as a person who gets things done for the people in his district. So I think if an opportunity came along, he might consider it for the U.S. Senate, but no guarantee either way.
I think he would definitely consider it.
I think it's 20, but this is the thing with Senate seats. I mean, it's every 6 years, and it's a difference between David Cicilline being still a fairly young man in his early 60s, if Reid retired in 26, versus the next opening that would then be not till Sheldon Whitehouse in 2030 or Reid in 2032. Now you're talking about running as a 70-something. Now, that's still young in the U.S. Senate these days, but, you know, it's just people's calculus changes.
I'm going to throw out there, too, that he doesn't have to, wouldn't have to retire in an election year, Ted. So, it might be, you know.
You know, I don't know if you caught his floor speech, his last floor speech that was attended by Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, but throughout it, he was thanking all the Republicans that he had worked with over, you know, throughout the years across the aisle in different legislation. And I'm listening to this going, where's David Cicilline? What have you done with him, you know? And I wondered if that was pivoting to his new job, where he can't be as hyper-partisan as we've seen him be over the past three decades, or if there was even more of an outlook that, hey, if he were to run for Senate or something more statewide, we're not just talking about the very left, very blue first congressional district anymore. You have to draw on the entire state of Oklahoma.
I actually think it was something different. I think it was genuine. I think it is the actual life on Capitol Hill is so much different from what is reflected back to people at home from news coverage, from the way politicians are acting on Twitter. Because why, if David Cicilline works with Fred Upton from Michigan on a bill regarding, you know, red alerts system in an active shooter, but Fred Upton was a Republican from Michigan, it doesn't lead the news every night for a week. It doesn't lead to a lot of spicy sound bites. It doesn't get a lot of attention. There's also, Sheldon Whitehouse has all these bipartisan bills on the oceans with Dan Sullivan from Alaska. He works with John Cornyn from Texas, who's high in the Republican leadership. It's just not as exciting, so it doesn't get as much attention. So then I think people at home kind of have a misperception that it's all the partisan fighting, and there's plenty of that, but there's a lot of compartmentalizing in Washington, I think, where people see it almost like a sports team, right? Like, they're like, all right, we have to, I think Sheldon Whitehouse mentioned to me, he's like, there's issues where you got to fight tooth and nail, and both sides understand that's what we're doing on this one, maybe a Trump thing or something, and then there's issues where we're putting that aside, and we're going to see if we can actually legislate, and I do think Cicilline, over time, like, especially with Ken Buck from Colorado, who is his colleague on antitrust stuff.
Yeah, he mentioned Ken Buck a lot.
I think it was genuine.
All right. Let's stick with you here. You surveyed the campaigns earlier this week on campaign finances. What do the war chests look like? I mean, and we should point out, when's the next filing deadline?
Mid-July is when they have to tell us again. So I've been doing this in recent congressional election cycles, just asking, how much money do you have right now? Because, yes, they don't have to file with the FEC, but they're perfectly capable of telling me. I bet they know how much money they have right now, you know?
Down to the dime.
Exactly. And, of course, as I've seen in past campaigns, a bunch of campaigns are unwilling to say. They want to keep it a secret. Sometimes that's because their fundraising's not going that well and they're hoping it gets better before they have to report. Other times, maybe they think it's going pretty well and they think they can have a big splash when they report to the FEC. But one candidate campaign that was willing to do it was, again, Gabe Amo's campaign. They said he's now raised about $275,000 with a month to go in the quarter, which is a pretty good number, and he was going to need very good fundraising to compete with existing office holders. Then we also had State Senator Sandra Cano said they expect to have $250,000 by June 30th. Aaron Regenberg is expected to be at least in the twos because he was already raised well over $100,000 in his early days in the campaign. What we don't know is how is fundraising going for Sabina Matos, who's never been in a race that needed this level of fundraising, but who is perceived as a front runner.
But even with that amount of money, these people, most of them, have no name recognition. And $250,000 is not a lot of money to get you that name recognition. The other thing is, a lot of these people have consultants they brought on board. The consultants are expensive. The consultants may put a great plan together, but when you're ready to implement it, you have no money. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be some of their problems in this short campaign. You know, you need a lot more than $250,000 to get a strong message out there. So I think they have to do a lot more fundraising to get themselves in position. Gabe has like zero name recognition in the state. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a lot of money to get known. You know, the lieutenant governor does have some name recognition. Aaron Regenberg has some name recognition. That helps him. Sandra Connell, she's from Pawtucket. She has name recognition there because she's run citywide before. But a lot of these people are going to really have to raise more money.
And consultants are expensive, aren't they?
The two of you know. Other person to watch who I didn't mention yet is Don Carlson, the Jamestown investor, former aide to Joe Kennedy II, not Joe Kennedy III. You know, we don't know exactly how much money he has, but, you know, and I've talked to the other campaigns. They're all wondering that. They're like, is this someone who can put a couple hundred thousand? Is this someone who's going to drop $1 million into his campaign? Mm-hmm. Not to say that that decides the race, but it certainly can change the calculus for the others.
So I do think that strategery and those expensive consultants are going to matter because the investment clearly.
Aren't you a consultant yourself?
I mean, maybe.
Okay.
So is he.
But a local consultant, which I think is a distinction in a race like this.
And you know, like we know where the pockets are. And also pockets of votes, where
not
the pockets
money.
Of votes are. Yes, I think it's important then to be really smart strategically. Mm-hmm. And so you could spend all of your money, you know, on TV or radio, and get your name recognition up very little, particularly in the summer months.
Right.
Or you could really invest in a smart field operation that IDs your voters and turns them out. And I think that's probably where the win will be, is the person who finds that really strong field operation and gets people excited about them. And even if they have low name recognition now, they do the work with free media and kind of build the building blocks of a fairly traditional campaign. Because I do think with this many candidates, it does come down to getting to know people, shaking hands, being like, oh, I met that guy. And then getting a follow-up phone call from the campaign, making sure you turn out and vote on August
16th. Turnout is going to be so low, too. This is one where you might identify all your voters who are coming out. It's not like a big presidential year race where there's this huge flow of voters coming in, drawn in by like the presidential, and you don't know where they're going to land on a general assembly race or something like that.
But you can, if you're smart and strategic about your field program, identify your people, get them out August 16th.
Right, as Joe said.
And then focus in the remaining weeks on getting the random folks who might be getting interested in the campaign.
I think that's also why endorsements are going to be very important. Mm-hmm. For example, union endorsements. You know, there's two teacher unions. If they go with one candidate, they could get their union members out, which is a lot of votes. The different mayors in the first congressional district, if they united behind one candidate and use their organizations, they could bring out a lot of voters. Again, all grassroots, you're 100% correct.
And I think that's something I'm waiting for. We haven't seen any major union endorse in this race so far. The AFL, I don't know if the AFL will do an endorsement because I bet the individual unions will probably be divided. But the teachers' unions, where do the laborers go? Sabina Matos, I know, visited Armin Sabatoni down in Washington. You know, I remember in the governor's race last year when the unions, you know, there was a period where the unions, some of them were still thinking, are we going to stick with the governor? Or they were kind of, you know, feeling their, and then the governor's team consolidated them. That was huge for him when he had all that.
Right.
The laborers union really saved the governor's bacon in June when he didn't have a lot of money yet, and they got on TV for him. So if you see a union consolidation here, I do think that could make a difference. Yeah.
I just want to shift gears a little bit. We have about 2 minutes left or so. The debt ceiling vote passed the Senate on Thursday night. We're taping this on a Friday morning. I just wonder if you guys think, was this a win for Biden, a win for Speaker McCarthy, both or neither?
It's a good question. I think certainly Speaker McCarthy getting something through, keeping his caucus together after the difficult start he had.
Far more Democrats voted for it than Republicans.
Yeah, but he had to get the rule passed out of his. Yes. There's a lot of internal
dynamics.
That was
dynamics. The bigger hurdle. It
exactly.
Felt like. Yeah, yeah.
You know, by the end it was kind of baked in the cake. I do think Biden you know, there's a lot of Democrats criticizing him. I will say sometimes it's easier to focus on what's in the bill and what's, as opposed to what didn't get into the bill. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I actually thought the White House was going to have to give up more to get something through the Republican House. They kept most of the climate stuff from the, I think all the climate stuff from the Inflation Reduction Act last year. So, you know, and I actually, the Politico had an interesting story yesterday saying the White House has actively for the last week avoided any arguing publicly they'd done a good job because they worried it would hurt the Republican voting in the House. Right. They wanted to let McCarthy beat his chest, get his votes, and then they would start to say what they got.
And they'll probably do some chest beating when he signs the bill.
Exactly.
And we'll see all that in a minute.
I think it was a shared win, mainly because the impact around the country would have been devastating to everybody involved. So I think they can chest beat now or chest beat later, just happy it got done.
Interesting divide, too, Tim, because Senator Reid in White House in Rhode Island, they voted for the bill. Senator Markey and Warren in Massachusetts, they voted no. You see how different those two delegations have gotten.
We've talked about this, so push comes to shove, though. If it was a two-vote margin, you have to wonder if Markey and Warren would still have been.
I have my doubts, but they didn't have to, so they took the protest vote.
All right, let's bring up some key dates for elections that we have coming up. As I said, September 5th is the primary, and then the general election is November 7th. But I think, as we all agree, September 5th is the big date because it's the Democratic primary will most likely decide this race. Joe Fleming, Kara Cromwell, Ted Nesi, welcome back. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next week.